And good morning, 6 minutes after 8 a.m. Central, 9 Eastern. I'm Joe Corcoran for WKU Public Radio with a look at our state and regional news at this hour. As you've been hearing all morning, House and Senate negotiators will be back at work this afternoon on Capitol Hill, trying to work out a last-minute deal to keep the government funded past tonight's midnight deadline. House Republicans Saturday passed a resolution to keep the funding coming, but to take out funding for Obamacare and delay that for a year. Kentucky Republicans Senator Rand Paul says he's hopeful a compromise can be worked out, blaming President Obama for a refusal to negotiate. But regardless of what happens tonight, another major deadline is looming just over 2 weeks from now. Paul told WKU Public Radio the nation's debt ceiling has to be raised by October 17th.
There's a lot of deadlines, and unfortunately, people don't come together to talk until the deadlines come. And so with the deadlines, hopefully it forces people to talk and find a middle ground. I think we lurch from deadline to deadline, and I think that's not a good idea. And personally, I would have started 2 or 3 months ago on this to try to get it beforehand.
Yep. Paul said Obama is taking a my way or the highway approach to both the government funding and the debt ceiling. Meanwhile, Kentucky Congressman Hal Rogers claims Democrats are mischaracterizing the action taken over the weekend by his majority Republican Party in the House as an attempt to shut down the government. Rogers is a Republican from Pulaski County who chairs the Appropriations and Revenue Committee. Says the House approved a continuing resolution to keep the government operating until December 15th.
To say that what we're after is to shut down the government is just not so. This is a continuing resolution. This continues the government. Like it or not, but that's what it does.
And Rogers says there are two amendments to the resolution. One continues pay for military personnel should the government shut down, and the other delays funding for the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare. Rogers denies it's an attempt to kill that program. He claims it just postpones appropriating any money for it for a year while problems with the ACA are worked out. But regardless, Kentucky's Health Benefit Exchange launches an open enrollment campaign tomorrow, kicking off its effort to enlist more than 600,000 uninsured Kentuckians in a health care plan. Carrie Bohannon is executive director of the exchange. She says the governor, lieutenant governor, and other state officials will be joining the initiative.
We'll be in Louisville, Hazard, Lexington, Bowling Green, Ashland, Covington, Mayfield, and Owensboro. And we'll be stopping at schools, hospitals, health departments, and libraries.
And she says the mobile tour is designed to get the word out concerning the federal ACA and the insurance plans available to individuals through the Kentucky Exchange. And representatives from the all 91 Confucius Institutes across the U.S. met in Bowling Green over the weekend. As Emil Moffitt reports, the program is being lauded for bringing American and Chinese cultures together.
It was the first time the meeting was held on U.S. soil. The Confucius Institute is designed to spread Chinese language and culture across the U.S. and vice versa. Madam Zhu Lin is Director General of the Chinese Education Ministry. She says one of the most important parts of the program is the opportunity to actually go and experience another culture.
Many young students and young teachers, when they come back to China, they always say they are lucky. They compare with the general people. So I think it's a mutual benefit.
Lin says other U.S. universities are looking to WKU's Confucius Institute as the model. She says as the numbers one and two economies in the world, Americans and the Chinese need to know as much as they can about the other culture. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Emil Moffitt.
And I'm Joe Corcoran for WKU Public Radio. I imagine you were as surprised as everyone else when the announcement came down.
I certainly was. In fact, I learned of this as I was backing out of my driveway and tuned into NPR. And immediately... It got my attention at a whole new level when I realized that the Pope had actually acted to submit his resignation.
What happens now? The cardinals convene to select a new Pope.
Well, we're in somewhat uncharted territory, but it allows them as much time, you know, as they've ever had in the past when a Pope dies. And sometimes popes have died after a prolonged illness, but oftentimes they've died rather unexpectedly. And so the cardinals are to convene. So if anything, there's really more time for preparation under these circumstances than there have been historically in the past.
Now, I realize it's only been a pope for 8 years, but what will his legacy be?
His legacy will be multifaceted. You know, just last fall, he convened bishops from around the world to hold a synod on the new evangelization. And what he was trying to effect there was to try to recognize that in those nations, like in Europe and in North and South America, where the church has flourished for centuries, the church is in decline, at least in terms of membership, up against issues of materialism and secularism. And the Pope's asking, how can we rekindle the fire of faith and the presence of the Holy Spirit in those who have already professed the faith, have already been baptized? He'll be remembered as a Pope with a great compassion for the poor, always speaking out when there were instances where poverty or want or droughts were affecting the livelihoods of people. He called upon the nations of the world to respond to that. He'll be remembered as an apostle of peace because whenever there was armed conflict anywhere in the world, or even before armed conflict came, he would speak eloquently and prophetically, trying to call people to peaceful resolution of the differences between nations. And certainly no small part of it will be this very action to recognize his own frailty and his own limitations and determine that for the good of the church, he should step down in a most irregular fashion.
He's written a new book looking back on his life and career, and he joins us now to talk about it. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, your book is called A Voice in the Box, My Life in Radio. And that's exactly what you wanted to be ever since you were a kid, a voice in the box.
We had a big Zenith radio from 1939. It was the first thing my parents bought when they got married. So it's a huge thing. It's in my living room today. But yeah, as a little kid, I kept going up to that box and wanting to be one of the voices inside of there.
Yeah, you sum up the irony of your career, you know, starting at the very beginnings of NPR in just its third year and helping it grow. And now with Sirius XM Radio at the very beginning of its life. Was it the same lures that made you want to be part of both the newness, the potential of it?
No, it was a happy accident. It was a nice opportunity that was handed me when the CEO of XM, it was just XM at that point, took advantage of all the adversity in my life at the time and made me an offer. And I thought, yeah, here's something else that's new, and I can be part of that. It's so exciting to join an organization when it's very young and finding its way and being a part of helping it become something, you know? And I got to do that twice now.
You write in your book that you're still not sure why you were, in your word, fired from NPR, but you devote a lot in the book to that time in your career.
Yeah, I mean, we were the number one program in all of public radio. Of course, it still is. What was I doing wrong? It wasn't that they told me I was doing anything wrong. So, you know, radio is a matter of taste, and one day they decide they want to hear somebody else, and so they make a change. And I think that's pretty much what happened.